The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, it was the last day of this past legislative session that state senators passed Georgia's fiscal year 2024 budget, and there was quite a bit of back and forth regarding a $66 million funding cut to the University System of Georgia.
Does this cut to funding disproportionately affect smaller schools, and can we avoid that?
Senator from the 49th, I think you've hit on the point that many of the members here, I think, are driving home with their questions, which is, it does not have to. And that question is left up to USG and the Board of Regents. If they want to apply it across the board, I'm sure schools that are smaller with less carry forward funds are going to be impacted more. But if they want to apply it differently, they are not only allowed to, they are constitutionally empowered to.
So what does that mean? In other words, so what now? USG Chancellor Sonny Perdue joins me in just a moment as he talks about the impact of the funding cut, plus his official response to Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones questioning DEI funding at these institutions. Also, we'll hear about a local law firm and how they're creating a pipeline for more lawyers of color, beginning at the high school level. All that's coming up, but first this. That partial crane collapse in Midtown yesterday injured 4 construction workers and led to an evacuation of residents in the surrounding area. In a press briefing held earlier today, Atlanta City officials shared that the 4 workers have been hospitalized with non-life-threatening injuries. Atlanta Fire Department Chief Rod Smith says about 1,000 homes have been evacuated, but did not have an estimate on the number of people affected. Now, Chief Smith added, engineers are still evaluating the safety of the under-construction building and could not confirm a timeline for when folks could return.
We've developed a defensive posture, and we have asked them to stay away from the homes. Once we come up with a neutralization solution for the crane, then we will deem it safe, and we will give them the opportunity to return home.
And again, the reason for the evacuation is to ensure the structure of the building and dismantle the damaged crane. Mayor Andre Dickens says the city is working with the Red Cross to house displaced residents, including the use of one of the city's recreation centers. As of airtime, street closures remain in effect for West Peachtree and Spring Streets between 10th and 12th. In other news, housing affordability, what else, is a growing concern in Metro Atlanta despite housing prices falling slightly. But as Marlon Hyde reports, a new federal bill could help local teachers and first responders buy those first homes.
Democratic U.S. Senator John Ossoff is sponsoring bipartisan legislation to help public servants with down payments. The bill would create a one-time home loan program that would allow qualifying applicants to buy homes without a down payment or monthly mortgage insurance costs. Eligible jobs include teachers, law enforcement officers, firefighters, paramedics, and emergency medical technicians. Senator Ossoff announced the new bill at a press conference at a Roswell firehouse.
You want firefighters and police officers to be able to live in the communities they serve. That down payment can be an impediment.
Ossoff says the idea is based on a program that serves veterans. He said how much this bill would cost taxpayers is still to be determined. Marlon Hyde, WABE News.
Georgia U.S. Senator Raphael Warnock is continuing his campaign to lower insulin prices. He joined diabetes patients and advocates in Atlanta this week, as we hear from Jess Mador.
A $35 a month cap on insulin for seniors with Medicare took effect in January, and Warnock is co-sponsoring a bill that would extend the cap to all diabetics. Warnock spoke at Southside Medical Center in the Atlanta Peoplestown neighborhood.
This is not a partisan issue, it's a human issue. If you look at the math, it's the smart thing to do.
More than 7 million Americans need insulin to manage their diabetes, and insulin prices have skyrocketed over the last decade, even for people with insurance. Atlanta resident Tommy Marshall has insurance, and he still pays $600 a month out of pocket for his insulin.
Pharmacists, almost every time I'll go in, the pharmacist is like, do you understand how much this is? And they look at me kind of wide-eyed, and I'm like, yeah, but I need this to be healthy and to manage this disease. You just fork over the money.
The American Diabetes Association is backing a different bill from Democratic New Hampshire Senator Jean Shaheen and Maine Republican Susan Collins. It would also cap out-of-pocket insulin costs at $35 a month, help reduce patient premiums, and increase competition in the insulin market. Jess Mador, WABE News.
Finally, a new film studio is in the works in South Fulton County. Kane Studios would be several times larger than Trilith and Tyler Perry Studios. That's big. This would be a 1,600-acre campus about 30 miles south of Atlanta. And the $700 million project would open in Chattahoochee Hills near the Serenbe community. It's estimated the project could generate $6 million in tax revenue. That's about the equivalent of 10,000 homes. According to the city's mayor, says they could use the money for roads and public safety. Meanwhile, the studio's developer says the plan is to preserve the area's rural character as much as possible. The Chattahoochee Hills City Council plans to vote on zoning changes for the project next month. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Earlier this month, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed a tax exemption and the state budget, that would be House Bill 19, into law. Now, Kemp signed both measures during a ceremony on the site of the Hyundai Meta plant in Bryan County.
We're also making history by restoring the HOPE scholarship and grant programs to their full promise, covering 100% of tuition at all public university and technical college institutions. In short, this budget improves the quality and access to education across the board.
Now, what Governor Kemp didn't specifically address was the $66 million cut in funding to the University System of Georgia. Now, there are about 26 public colleges and universities within the system. Now, USG will receive about $3.1 billion. Still, the decrease cuts differently depending on the institution. USG's chancellor is Sonny Perdue, a longtime elected official who has served pretty much at every level of government, including U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, of course, Georgia governor, and state senator. And Chancellor Perdue joins me in studio, so welcome to Closer Look. It's been some time.
Good afternoon, Rose. Glad to be back with you.
You know, and I told you this before we came on air, so I just want to be very transparent about it. I was thinking about the last time that I was covering you, and I remember during the cheating scandal, the early phase of the cheating scandal with APS, and you were called to testify on Judge Baxter, and you were very emotional about wanting to make sure children would not be harmed, wanting to make sure that there was accountability, because this was impacting kids and their ability to learn. And I thought about, well, maybe some of these students are now within the university system. So when you think about these cuts, and you have said what this would do to the families and to those households, for some they may say, well, it's not that big of a cut. It's less than 2% overall. But that matters, right?
Rose, it's interesting that you would mention that. Honestly, my LinkedIn, when I came back from USDA in D.C., I had born a dirt farmer, tried a couple other jobs, but never could escape. when I was offered this job by the Regents, I changed my LinkedIn profile because I thought they probably expected something a little more erudite than that.
Yeah.
And I said, Chancellor of the University System of Georgia, possibly the most impactful job I've ever had. And when you mentioned the APS, really literally, I don't try to be melodramatic, but chills came over because of the emotions of that. And it's the same way today. Those students may be probably likely in college today, and we were failing them. So my goal and my desire is for us not to fail children. Obviously, it takes appropriations. It takes funding. Mm-hmm. And the USG system of Georgia has been fortunate over 30 years since Zell Miller and the Hope Scholarship and his investment in higher education really put Georgia on a trajectory of becoming one of the best systems in the country. And my goal is to continue to pursue that, to be the best.
Your annual budget is about $9.8 billion, mm-hmm. That's correct? That for overall?
Overall, yes.
And now, does that include what the General Assembly allocates as well as tuition and fees, or is that separate, that $9.8 billion?
That's totally inclusive. Federal funds, all the other type of research grants and others.
So what's the funding formula to determine how much an institution will receive? I mean, they all have different sizes, sure. Enrollment, faculty and staff and all that.
Formula funding, which frankly is about 40 years old, it was put in 1983 and really has not been changed significantly since that time, really bases its formula on credit hours, as long as some for maintenance of operation and other types of necessary things to conduct an institution and create an environment where students can learn. So it's based on credit hours. How many credit hours, not just students, but are they taking 6 hours, are they taking 12 or 15 hours? Mm-hmm. How many credit hours are produced? That's the formula that we are funded by.
I take it that formula needs to maybe change?
I think there's room for that. We've not broached that with the General Assembly. We have mentioned to them the fact that we are still being funded at an M&O, maintenance and operation, of about $7, a little over $7 a square foot. And our expenditure is about 12 to 13. Mm-hmm. Anyone in today's environment knows there have been inflationary pressures, obvious from everything from gasoline to groceries to labor to just anything.
And for listeners who may not understand, I want you to fully, if you can, because you have some time, what you all pay for, I mean, the buildings and what the institutions are responsible mm-hmm. for. If there's a new building, who pays for that?
Well, the state typically will fund most of it, most of the time. But our foundations, our philanthropic foundations for each institution, they're raising a lot of private funds as well. Mm-hmm. And the combination of those funds some buildings. Some of them are totally privately funded. Some of them are totally public funded. But it's the combination there that continues the university system the opportunity to grow.
Have you been to every institution?
I did. I mm-hmm. felt like that was my responsibility last summer. After I got the job, I was able to get to all 26 institutions fairly quickly. I think by the middle of the summer, I had visited everyone. And, you know, everybody likes to see the new guy.
Would you hear that you can share from some of the presidents, professors, students? What stands out to you?
What I heard was there was a lot of enthusiasm. There was a lot of excitement and a lot of opportunity. And what was most impactful, Rose, was that many people, most all people, understood that higher education is the ticket to a transformative lifestyle. We call it a million-dollar deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, statistics and data show that those young people who get a four-year degree over their career are going to be about $1 million better off at the end of their career having had that degree. Our competition right now is really the workplace. Mm-hmm. High school students that maybe never had any money getting out of high school, getting a $20, $25-an-hour job, they say, wow, why should I pay you to go to school if I can make this kind of money? The problem is 4, 5, 10 years down the road, they're still making that kind of money mm-hmm. where their peers who went to college, got a four-year degree, are advancing.
And technology plays a role in it.
No doubt.
I want to go back to the last day of the legislative session, this past session. Mm-hmm. A lot of back and forth with someone you know, Senator Blake Tillery, who also yes. serves as chair of the Appropriations mm-hmm. Committee. And the fellow senators regarding funding for the system, I want to play one of the cuts here.
Okay.
The reduction at teaching is now $66 million, with the direction that they focus on their carry-forward funds to help cover that cost. Also point out, remember, that enrollment's been declining. When there's probably other ways that businesses would use to to handle that as well.
So we'll get to the carry forward funding in a moment, but Senator Tillery talked about declining enrollments. Mm-hmm. And to your knowledge, that's not for every institution, but this is a concern for you all.
It is a concern. 20 out of 26 institutions had declining enrollment. So that has to do with demographic, the work opportunities, as I mentioned earlier, the college-going demographics there. We've got kids that are not going to school like they once were. So those are all challenges, and our enrollment people are really working hard to determine what that is, to reach out and to market the advantage for higher education to them.
You of all folks, you know how this process works, Chancellor Perdue. Did you have any notion ahead of signing the or maybe even before the session started, at any time, that the funding to the system could be cut? Did you have any notion?
Rose, we had had a great relationship. We, the General Assembly, we had a big ask in the amended budget of the $105 million to preserve the Medical College of Georgia for the electronic medical records. The House and the Senate agreed to that. So we had no thought that we thought everything was fine. I testified in the committees, told them what our needs were. Actually, this year was interesting in that we had only $7.5 million of growth overall in the system, net growth. Some colleges, six of those had some growth, but the negative from the other 20 had only a net growth of $7.5 million. Typically, it had been $100 million or more in previous years. So we felt good about the system. We felt that we would, while we wouldn't have as much money as we needed, we were prepared to do what it took and to withstand that. So we were a little bit blindsided by the late actions.
Did you listen to that final day?
I did. Oh, absolutely.
Senator Tillery cited the $66 million reduction was in the teaching program. Now, I want to take this further for our listeners. Is that that's instructors? That's so you all, the way the line item works in the budget. So this was specific, the $66 million in the teaching program.
Yes, I think it was $66 million in the block grant that we get. He may have referred to the teaching program, but
that's what he said.
It's to the block grant, the $3.1 million that the General Assembly appropriates was $66 million short of what our formula fundings earnings would have been.
Did it appear, Chancellor, that that day some of the lawmakers, because with their questions and comments, it seemed very scripted and justifying the massive cut? Was that your takeaway?
Having served in the Senate for 11 or 12 years, it did seem like some of the questions might have been pre-prepared in that regard. And unfortunately, I think there was some unfortunate misinformation that went on regarding the carry forward and how the ability we had to make up for that cut.
I want to talk about that because, and I printed out a copy for you because I want to make sure you had one. But when we talk about this carry forward funds, and I have here the breakdown of what each institution has in terms of those carry forward funds. But I want to play this clip again. It's from Senator Shelley Echols back on Sine Die asking this.
Does this cut to funding disproportionately affect smaller schools? And can we avoid that?
Senator from the 49th, I think you've hit on the point that many of the members here, I think, are driving home with their questions, which is, it does not have to. And that question is left up to USG and the Board of Regents. If they want to apply it across the board, I'm sure schools that are smaller with less carry forward funds are going to be impacted more. But if they want to apply it differently, they are not only allowed to, they are constitutionally empowered to.
And I want to dissect for our listeners. Sure. And we have a list here. You have a list. What does this mean? This carry forward balances is from the previous fiscal year, right?
The previous fiscal year or years. Mm-hmm. Let me first of all tell you how this carry forward funds, which are specific to the institution, those are institutional funds. They're not state funds. They are created by indirect cost recovery. If, for instance, they got a $100 million grant, they are allowed to peel some of it off into indirect cost recovery for the back office operations that are needed to support that grant. That's one of them. Auxiliary funds, tuition, and other auxiliary funds also. So,
because Senator Tillery made it sound like this cut, you all could just, the institution just take from this, they'll be fine. Not to put words in his mouth, but it would be helpful because institutions would have these carried forward balances where I'm looking at this here, and it's you have a copy there too.
Sure.
As I my granddad would say, that ain't much for some of them.
I think there was a conflation maybe of ideas. When they give us a block grant, the Board of Regents does have the discretion to allocate among the institutions as they see fit. And to some degree, we do that among the state-appropriated funds. For instance, this year, we're having to mitigate the gainers, the ones that grew there. Mm-hmm. They're only getting 50% of their gain, whereby some of the ones that had declining are only getting 30% of their losses. Mm-hmm. We can do that with the state funds. With the carry-forward funds, we don't have that same discretion. And as you can see from your chart, mm-hmm. those carry-forward funds, 82% of them were in the top six institutions. So some of these smaller institutions had very, very little money to mitigate.
Yeah, if you're Georgia Tech or UGA, right. maybe Georgia State.
Right.
But listen, if you're Savannah State,
absolutely.
And I want to talk about Savannah State yeah. for a moment, because the HBCUs that are part of the system, and I don't need to tell you, you know the plight of right. many HBCUs sure. in this nation. So, Chancellor, with this now, this cut, and we've been down this road before, are y'all having conversations, whether they're official or not, about could this lead to merging some institutions? That's been floated before, you know. Right. And specifically speaking of Savannah State, an institution like that.
Let me say unequivocally that consolidation or merger is not on the table anywhere, particularly Savannah State, because there's been a rumor down there politically, I think, of that being a possibility. Mm-hmm. That's not a consideration at all. I think we have three HBCUs in this state. Rose, I keep telling the community down there, you can't tell me why Savannah State shouldn't be one of the top premier HBCUs in the Southeast mm-hmm. where it's located. And we got a lot of work to do, and we plan to do it. But there's no talk of consolidation. The consolidation 5 or 6 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, with Armstrong and Georgia Southern mm-hmm. Created some confusion down there, thinking that Georgia Southern may come down and take over that. That is not in the works at all. I want to reassure anyone listening to Savannah State, anyone that's concerned about HBCUs, neither Fort mm-hmm. Valley, Albany, or Savannah, no consolidation.
All right. Glad you cleared it up. Yep. If you're just joining Closer Look, I'm joined by University System of Georgia Chancellor Sonny Perdue. And, of course, the focus of our conversation is that of the massive $66 million funding cut. Now, you called this decrease, quote, incredibly disappointing outcome, given the work done over the years by our state leaders to elevate higher education and send Georgia on a path to ascension. You got a response. Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, let's be really clear, took offense. And in response, started asking about what institutions were spending on DEI programs, which the lieutenant governor has called, I'm going to quote him here, particularly concerning when taxpayer funds are used to enforce the type of intellectual and political conformity that appears to be the hallmark of many campus DEI initiatives. Chancellor, first of all, your thoughts, let me back up. Do you subscribe to that same ideology as Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones about DEI programs?
Let me first say that as a public entity, our obligation is to be transparent to the public funders, the legislature, the governor, and all the taxpayers of Georgia about where our money is spent.
Okay.
We're happy to do that. That's our obligation. It should be an open book, and it is from that perspective. My comment regarding the $66 million being particularly disappointing, Georgia has had a 30-year history of investing in higher education. The economic development successes that we've seen over the last several years, I think, are directly related to the investment that we've made in skills and knowledge and a talent base where companies, major companies, want to come to Georgia to put their companies because the talent is here mm-hmm. at all levels, both from technical college as well as
a diverse talent base.
No doubt. No doubt at all. And
well, go ahead and finish.
And I think, again, relating to the fact that what we're doing, it's appropriate for them to ask what we're spending in every area. As chancellor, just like I was governor, I'm going to look line item by line item
okay.
and see where every institution is spending money.
So you have no problem with providing the information.
No.
Do you subscribe to his ideology about DEI initiatives in his sense, and a lot of others, not just Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, but a lot of folks that have this perception of DEI initiatives as not being beneficial. He says, he calls it concerning to enforce a type of intellectual and political conformity.
I think what we're
in other words, he doesn't like it.
Well, I think again, when you talk about diversity and inclusion, what that needs to be a broad definition, obviously. Well, there are a lot of ways of a diversity. What we're seeing, obviously, on campuses, not so much in Georgia, but across the country, is not a diversity of intellectual thought and the shout downs and people you disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
Universities ought to be a hotbed of differing opinions. Rose, you and I had different upbringings. We were different. We brought different things to our life. The legislature, I remember, not everybody thought the way I thought when I came to the legislature.
You've had some battles.
It educated me about understanding.
The flag was one of them.
Flag,
you were a man on an island, yeah. In a sense, with some of your fellow Republicans there for a minute. Were you not?
I was on one side and the others were on the other side.
You were a man
sure.
on an island. Yeah.
I don't know if it was an island.
You didn't have a lot of people on that island.
That's right.
It was really clear.
It was populated. But anyway, the fact is that our goal at the University of Georgia is to create a environment of civil discourse where people of all natures, all backgrounds, all can come and speak freely. The Regents have just passed a great principles and policies about academic freedom mm-hmm. and freedom of expression. We want our universities to be bastions of First Amendment rights for all people.
You're going to provide this information. How long? First of all, have you provided? Is it going to take some time? And how do you all define what is a DEI program?
We're accumulating that now. Our mm-hmm. institutions are reporting back to us. We have most of those, but as you might imagine, just your question, we want to make sure they're all apples and oranges in that way. So we are collating that to get the information to the legislature, to the Senate, to Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, as well as his members, as well as the House, to see what that is.
You just talked about freedom protections, mm-hmm. not just for faculty and staff, but can you understand that this ideology— in which a lot of talking points for many Republicans, state and federal, regarding DEI and CRT and all that. Can you understand a faculty member being concerned that they might be penalized or their program might be subjected to being cut? If this is Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones' response, well, maybe if you cut your DEI programs, y'all can save some money.
The good news, Rose, is I would encourage you and your listeners to look at the principles that the Board of Regents passed in April. Mm-hmm. It actually goes back to the AAUP, which is the American Association of University Professors, their statement of academic freedom in 1940. As long as a professor is talking about the content, it gives them freedom to do research wherever they want to research and proclaim that in that way. There are some constraints to that. If I'm a math teacher, I can't. It's not my role to bring biology into the math class that way. So there are—
Unless you're counting, you know.
Well, there are—
Unless you're counting folk.
There are constraints to that, and the AAUP recognizes that with a definite statement.
I'm glad you mentioned the AAUP because yeah. they voted to censure the University System of Georgia, and this is through their words, quote, you good? Quote, the unilateral action of its administration and governing board to remove the protections of tenure and academic freedom from the system's post-tenure review policy. So based on everything you just said, and you highlighted AAUP, but then you all get this censured, I think, toward the end of last year. So what's the official response to that? And can you see someone saying, well, Chancellor, aren't you kind of contradicting yourself here?
Not really. That was on the actions based on what the Regents had done in post-tenure review.
Mm-hmm.
Many people in the workplace today don't understand tenure. And it became a fact that they think it's a lifetime role, like a federal judge appointing for life. And that's not really even the AAUP's definition of tenure. They believe that as long as someone is teaching the content for which they are academically free to research and to do that, they should have those protections. Post-tenure review was nothing more than an examination by their peers, by other faculty members, to make sure that professors were doing what they were entitled to do in their classrooms regarding that effort. It was not any way to do away with tenure mm-hmm. or anything else. It was a provision that many states use a post-tenure review to assess the quality of work that was being done.
Does this concern you, though? Because if you're and you talked about producing a 21st century workforce, which also means attracting national and international businesses and folks. But if you can't attract, quote, I guess, 21st century faculty because of this censure, that's a problem, too. Because for some professors, and I hear from them, this may be a red flag for them, and they don't want to come to the system.
I guess, Rose, I would disagree with your assumption and your premise. We have not noticed that at all. I think many people understand the AAU position. They certainly understand Georgia's position. We've not found that to be a barrier, and I've talked to various presidents overall. Some people may, if they just read the press, might think that's the way it is. But when they realize the principles that we've passed, again, affirming the 1940 statement of freedom of academic freedom and freedom of expression, I think they're relieved. I think faculties understand what we're trying to do.
Combine that and what you just said, and then with Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones's DEI request, do you have concerns, though, Chancellor, that this is going to create issues and you won't be able to attract, it could be students, who are saying, I'm not going to go there, it could be faculty and staff. They're cutting money. They've got, look, Texas, I know it's Texas, just passed to remove DEI initiatives, you know, from public universities and colleges. Does all that weigh on you? I mean, I'm not saying you do, but, do you have a concern?
Answer your question directly. No, I'm not concerned because of the way we've taken care of business. First Amendment is valuable. Freedom of expression is valuable. In Georgia, we deem that to be bilateral. Students have a right to speak their minds. Faculty have a right to speak their minds. We need to learn how to practice civil discourse because we don't always have the same life experiences. We don't bring the same things to the classroom or to the campus. Therefore, how do we learn to get along while we're uncomfortable about what you may believe or what I may believe?
But if you have a state legislature that can control the, I hate using that term, the purse strings, and if you have a legislature that, because of the political leaning, could vote to go like what Texas did. I mean, getting along is one thing, but if you are stripping DEI programs or CRT, and people always get it wrong about CRT, if you're stripping that, that's going to have a direct impact on your institutions and the faculty and students that you could be missing out on because they're not going to go there.
Well, I think you're fearful maybe for some of the wrong reasons. First of all, nothing has been stripped. The public funders have an absolute right to understand where our money is going in every category, and we're going to provide that to them. We're making progress in making, again, our university system of Georgia an atmosphere where people feel comfortable. There are campuses on this in this nation, Rose, where people don't have the freedom to speak up about, but they may be shouted down, other thing, where that their opinion is not welcomed. We want all opinions to be welcomed in that way, and that's what we're trying to strive for. We believe that will be actually an attraction to the university system of Georgia.
Do you feel Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones's request is in retaliation because you spoke out against the $66 million cut?
I don't necessarily think that. Mm-hmm. I think, again, he is attached to an area where many of his colleagues in the General Assembly have had questions about that. As you know, there's been a lot of the DEI programs since the George Floyd area, and I think people have a right to say, What are we getting? What's the ROI for that? What's the response here?
Okay. But do you feel that it was in retaliation?
No.
Have you talked to him?
I have.
You're smiling. How was that conversation?
It was very productive, actually. I'm an optimist, but I'm an optimist that the $66 million is going to be restored and we're going to be back. Georgia has a wonderful history, and it's like a long-term investment. We're long-term investors in higher education in Georgia. And Zell Miller got us started on that path, and it's been wonderful. And I don't see any fundamental reason the General Assembly would stop now in that regard, for any reason.
You said, I am encouraged by the fact that we think that will be restored as we come into the amended budget, given how, but you're encouraged. If you listen to Sonny Dye, you heard those lawmakers. I mean, they talked about everything from Kirby Smart's. By the way, Kirby Smart is the highest paid state official person on the payroll, right?
That's right.
Now, I love football. You know I'm a sports person. I'm not getting in Kirby's checkbook, but Kirby is the highest paid state official in Georgia.
And something we don't pay him enough.
That's a whole nother show. Your optimism remains high, though.
It does. Yes, I do. Because I've got confidence. Look, the last week or so of the General Assembly session was very highly emotional. It involved things that didn't involve higher education.
Yeah.
And frankly, I think we'll restore that. We'll be back where we need to be in the 24 amended budget and the 24 cycle.
Will you be back?
I will.
You want to remain in this?
Look, I think I told you, I believe this may be one of the most impactful jobs I've ever had. When you can have the impact over providing an environment where over 330,000, 35,000 young people can literally have their lives changed, where else can you do that? Higher education is the ticket. We talked about that. It's life-changing for young people, particularly first-generation students whose parents never go to college.
You don't need to tell me.
They get an opportunity. That's our job. And that's when we had four students at this last Board of Regents meeting stand up there from all different backgrounds, mm-hmm. and to see their intellect and see what they learned, it's inspiring.
And you tell me that. You got to make sure the lawmakers hear all that.
We're telling them that every day.
But well, they ain't listening because they just cut $66 million from your budget.
That didn't have anything to do with that.
Well, and listen, and before we go, because I did want to get to this too, because you know, these cuts, and I printed out the list here, you know, Augusta, they're looking at maybe out of the $66 million, maybe $6.8 million to Augusta University is not a big deal. But to some of these smaller schools, even to, you know, Columbus State, 1.2, Clayton State, 860,000. That can make a difference in whether one of those first-year students even gets to come to campus.
Rose, it also make a difference where those same people working there may be at work in there next year as
right.
well.
Yeah.
Those are lives. And that's the point we tried to make. That's why I'm optimistic that the legislature will come back and do what I believe is the right thing in restoring that funding going forward.
And then finally, as we begin to wrap up, you have talked about, you mentioned the HBCUs mm-hmm. and investments in HBCUs, investments in the PWIs, which are called predominantly white institutions. Do you see a disparity there within the system that perhaps needs to be fixed?
You know, many people have talked about that. I've looked at the numbers. Mm-hmm. I don't. In fact, really? The HBCUs with the federal dollars that were appropriated specifically for them over there, they've benefited more than the other institutions in the last 2 or 3 years regarding that. And our formula is really agnostic of what color you are. And so I don't see a disparity.
What can y'all do in the meantime to help these institutions? Because if these carry forward balances, these funds that Senator Tillery was touting, which you've already mm-hmm. said was a little bit conflated, what can y'all do in the meantime to help them?
What we've already done is to mitigate. Of those six schools that were the gainers, had gained and earned more, then mm-hmm. We have trimmed them back to get half of what they earned more and redistributed that to those that had lost enrollment and admissions. So we're trying to, I call it a little bit of a Robin Hood type of thing. We're doing the Robin Hood
thing. And look, if UGA folks, now listen, I don't want these emails from UGA and Georgia Tech, but look, now y'all better go ask Kirby.
Look, the presidents have been very understanding yeah. and very cooperative. I appreciate their willingness to understand they're going to get by. It's no like our economy. You know, if you lose $10,000 if you're a millionaire, you can stand a lot better if you're making $10,000 a year.
But 1%, as you know, anyone that has a household budget, 1% taken out of your budget, that could mean a generations of detriment.
When you're barely making it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sonny Perdue is the 14th chancellor for the University System of Georgia, which oversees 26 public colleges and universities. Chancellor, thank you for taking time. I appreciate it. Good to see you again.
Good to be with you again, Rose. Thanks. Thank you.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Well, we'll continue talking about DEI since it's everyone's favorite topic. But, you know, just this week, as I mentioned in that conversation with Chancellor Perdue in Texas, the Texas House voted to eliminate its DEI offices and programs at the state's public colleges and universities. And yes, DEI has become a political football. And while that continues, though, a local law firm is continuing its efforts to increase the number of people of color who go into the field of law by exposing students beginning at the high school level. Morris Manning and Martin, also known as, I call it the Triple M's, is seeking interns for its 13th annual high school internship program for diverse students. And according to the American Bar Association's 2020 profile, the legal profession is about 86% white and lacks diversity. So we're going to talk about all that now. Joining me now is Dan Nguyen, the chief diversity partner at Triple M, and Alanis Cummings, a former intern. Dan, Alanis, welcome to the program. I really appreciate it.
Rose, thanks for having us.
So here y'all go with some DEI stuff.
That's right. It's important.
Let's start there. Why are you all doing this? Why are you starting and you see a need? Of course, I mentioned that percentage there. So,
yeah, I think it's important to understand that, you know, this is something that we've been dealing with for a long time. I think you're right that the numbers reflect that the legal industry is kind of lagging behind in kind of having diverse talent. And so as a law firm, you know, we've been doing the high school internship program for 13 years. And so we thought that, you know, what was really important, and I can speak for myself, going through in high school, you know, I didn't really have mentors. I didn't have access to the legal field. And so, you know, the point of the program is to, you know, give high school students who are interested in the law kind of a first introduction.
You mentioned there was no one that you – well, representation matters is what you're saying. You didn't see anyone that you could say, hey, maybe I can talk to that person. They're from my community. They look like me. That was
absolutely. I think it's, you know, I think, you know, there was, you know, generations ago, I mean, you didn't really see many, I mean, you know, Asian American lawyers in Atlanta or other diverse lawyers just being successful. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of, you know, the candidates that we see, I've done hiring at law firms for 12 years. We are diverse candidates. They were generally, you know, first generation lawyers. So they were mm-hmm. kind of doing this without the help or input of family members or friends mm-hmm. or the community that could give them insight of what lawyers do.
With this internship, what type of students are you looking for?
Sure. So, you know, every year we put out the application to the high schools in Metro Atlanta. And then we ask for students that are interested in the law. And a lot of time, the high school applicants that we have, their only exposure to lawyers and law firms are what's on TV.
I was going to say, are you going to say Law and Order?
Law and Order. I think nowadays it's like Suits is really important. And I think that's a very a great way of figuring things out. But there's a lot of – that's the tip of the iceberg.
Alanis, I want to come to you for a moment because you are a former intern here. What drew you to this program? And you said, you know what? I'm going to check this out.
Yeah. So I actually was a part of an academy at my high school. It's called the Public Service Law and Media Academy. Mm-hmm. And that's our whole focus is kids that want to get into law. We focus on that. We learn different amendments and everything. And my teacher she introduced us to Morris Manning and Martin and their internship opportunity. And she encouraged me to go after it. And I did. And I got it. I was really excited. And it was a great opportunity for me.
Tell me about that experience. What did you learn? I imagine you learned a lot, but what do you remember?
We got exposed to so many different practices of law. Morris Manning and Martin has so many different business law practices. So she... Miss Sherry, she introduced us to many different lawyers. My favorite was litigation. Mm-hmm. We got to ask questions, and not only that, but she also showed us the diverse attorneys that were there. And it was nice seeing people that not only were they diverse, but they were young. So they told us how they got into law school and everything. So.
Dana, she didn't call you young, but
yeah. I'm right in the middle, I think. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. And
when
that's
you hear
kind of
her say that, what does that mean?
You know, it's reassuring. You know, when we're looking at our high school interns, and it's a competitive process. We have 12 to 14 every year, and Alanis and all of her classmates are super impressive, and it's great that we can pique their interest and open their curiosity. I always tell them that at the end of the internship, a success for me is if they have more questions mm-hmm. about the law, and we provide them resources that can continue after they finish with the program.
Do you often hear that concerns might be, because I just talked about this, being able to pay for law school, getting into law school, or just even getting in the undergrad first? Do you help them with that and helping them in terms of knowing what classes to take and picking the right institution if they do want to pursue a field in law?
Absolutely. I think one of the crucial parts of the internship is we pair them with an attorney that and hopefully even at the end of the internship, it's a lifelong mentorship. And you can ask questions like you just said. What can I major in? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not really limited to political science, you know, and how do you pay for law school? And what can you do after you graduate? There's limitless possibilities. And a lot of times you don't get that from, the Law and Order or Suits.
Do you know if this is something that other law firms are doing? Have you been people reaching out saying, hey, you know, this is something we might want to try? And, you know, what do you tell them?
Yeah, I think it's a great problem that we're having now is that we're getting a lot of competition. I think that the Georgia State Bar and the Atlanta Bar have competing programs. I think law firms are looking to kind of look at expanding the pipeline and attracting high school students. It's a problem that we have because there's a lot of resources and we're trying to compete for the best students. But I think that's a great solution that we have. There's a lot of other law firms trying to do this as well.
Alanis, what's next? What path are you on now?
Yeah, so I'm graduating in 2 days.
Yay.
And I'm going to be going to Emory University in the fall, double majoring in political science and African American studies.
And that is a good program. Wow. First of all, congratulations. Thank you. Over at Emory. Tell them I said hi. Dan, you hear that?
That's fantastic. And that's not surprising. I mean, the students that we get are so mature. They are always forward looking. We've been doing this for 12 years and we've had alumni of the internship program that are in law school now, that are lawyers, that are actively looking at law schools. So it's exciting. And what we've done now is, as a law firm, we've said, well, what's the next step? What can we do mm-hmm. aside from this internship program? Because that's the first step.
What is the next step you all are looking at?
Sure. So we've actively started paying for LSAT prep for diverse college students. And also we have a program where we offer LSAT prep for our diverse staff because mm-hmm. we'd be remiss to not – to assist the folks that help us out every day. You know, one of those things, and then the reason why we really focused on LSAT prep is, you know, a good LSAT score can mean the difference between acceptance, could mean the difference between a $50,000, $60,000 scholarship. And, prep classes, it's all about resources and access to resources. And that's what we're trying to kind of provide to diverse folks.
So you still follow up and you still continue to work with these interns, even if after they've gone through the program.
Sure, absolutely. That's kind of one of the lasting legacies that I want this program is it doesn't stop after they leave our doors. That's kind of the beginning. And I think this morning I just offered 3 LSAT prep programs for 3 diverse college students in Atlanta.
Alanis, what is your advice or suggestion to someone who might be listening and said, you know what, I was thinking about doing it. I'm not sure. What do you want these possible interns to know?
Go for it. Just go for it. I mean, I that's what I did and I got it and it was just a great experience. And I'm still if you even don't even want to go into law afterward, I mean, you make a lot of friends and you have a lot of connections with people. So all around, it's just a great opportunity.
And Dan, I have a question from a listener who says, do you all look at grades as a criteria for this process?
We look at a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Grades is a factor. One of the things that I say is we look at the holistic person, mm-hmm. what they're involved in. We elicit a recommendation from their teachers. So we look at everything. Grades is important, but that's certainly not the end all be all. That's not dispositive of a good candidate for this program or for the legal industry.
And the application process, where does it begin? Online, I imagine?
It begins online. We just finished our interviews for this summer. Yeah. But we're always happy to field questions for the next coming year. It's open to sophomores through seniors in high school.
So how many are going to come out of this process?
12, I think 12 this year. The program coordinator is always asking to expand the program, and we're working on it, but we usually have a class of 10 to 14 kids.
And when will those interns be notified?
They've been notified already.
So they know.
They do know, and we have a great class, and they're coming in. They're starting in June of this year.
And what's the first thing when you address the group, what do you tell them?
I tell them it's a great accomplishment, and this is something where, it's yours to take advantage of. And when I say that is, use kind of the relationships you build. Everyone that's here, everyone that's presenting to you is doing it on a volunteer basis. They want to help you. Mm-hmm. And it's really incumbent on the students to kind of follow that up. And I'd love to hear from my past students and my past interns what they're doing, or if they want letters of recommendation or guidance. It's up to them to kind of follow through with that that relationship.
And how important, again, as we begin to wrap up, Dan, is this when you look at the entire field, and particularly when you talk about future jurists,
mm-hmm.
And having a diverse candidate pool workforce in this industry?
Being a lawyer, I think it's a privilege. I've done a lot of recruiting even for the law schools. And one of the things that we need to do is in Georgia is make sure that our law schools are reflective of the demographics of our population. Because lawyers have the ability to speak for the folks that are underrepresented, to kind of chat, lead causes. If you don't have lawyers that are diverse, that reflect who we are as a population, you're going to get underserved populations, and that's not only in the corporate field, but also just in the social community.
And realistically, that statistic that I said about 86%, acceptable is the right word. What's an acceptable percentage then, where you feel like there's a little bit more equity or?
Sure. That's a great question. And that's something that I think a lot of folks in the DEI field and the legal industry have to deal with. And I think that's more of not a number, but as long as we're making progress year after year, that's how we guide success here.
Alanis Cummings, first of all, congratulations again. Best of luck to you over at Emory University. And thank you so much for taking your time. I was also joined in the studio by Dan Nguyen, the chief diversity partner at MMM. We call it MMM, the three M's. Thank you so much for coming in and taking time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are Daniel Razel, LaShawn Hudson. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerth. A reminder, send me your thoughts in an email. You know what to do, rose@wabe.org. And stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.